This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. In this show, we talk about value, the social and moral value of business. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. All right, most of you know that I'm a former investment banker turned business ethicist, and that I have a heart of a teacher, whether here with you or as a storyteller on Wall Street. And if you haven't figured it out just yet, I'll tell it to you straight. I'm on a mission. I'm on the hunt to bring you the angels of capitalism. These are the people doing the work of a more human-centered approach to capitalism. Last week, we talked with the Italian economic historian Paolo Santori and the Brazilian human right to dream activist Marion Castello. The three of us ping-ponged our way around the world as we talked about the economy of Francesco, the global movement of young economists, entrepreneurs, and changemakers who have been inspired by Pope Francis and the patron saint of peace himself, St. Francis of Assisi. This week, hold on to your passport. We're still traveling. We start in New York and then head to India with Megan Desai. Megan is a former ad agency protege who, after a decade in business, answered a call of the ancient Indian philosophy of dharma and has engaged a newly transformed family foundation into the leading voice for the economically and socially marginalized women of India. Megha's amazing work has empowered women in ways that break through centuries of marginalization. And now let's welcome to What Does It Profit, Megha Desai. Megha, how are you?
Hi, so lovely to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is a joy all the way around today because I'm in sunny Washington, D.C. The cherry blossoms are out. That's when you know it's spring. The blossoms and the drippy noses. It's
yes.
That time of year again. So where are you in the world today?
I am in New York City. I am also feeling the allergies, as you can hear. So thank you for spring allergies.
You know, we just take what comes, right? That's kind of a life thing. I've been watching your career, which is really exciting. So I think that's just part of maybe who you are anyway. So welcome. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Well, I know about you, but our listeners don't know about you. So let's introduce you to everyone. And it will become very obvious soon in the conversation why I wanted to bring you in to talk with me and introduce you to our listeners today. So sit back and relax, all of you listeners. Hey, Megha, let's talk. Your title now, let me make sure I get this right, is the president of the Desai Foundation. And so we're going to talk about how you got to be the president of the Desai Foundation. But I am really interested in kind of the path that led you to where you are now. So let's rewind the clock and introduce our listeners to you come from the corporate world, which is why we look for the angels of capitalism. So we're like, okay, Megha is one of those angels in our book. And so we want you to start there in your story. So where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a suburb of Boston.
But you don't have that accent. That Bostonian, rich, thick accent. We had Ken Feinberg, the special master of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. And when you listen to Ken, you hear Boston. So
it comes out every so often, different phrases and words. But I think the product of a bilingual home, often the accents aren't always what the surroundings sound like. So I think that's where that comes from.
But do you say wicked awesome?
I do. I definitely say wicked awesome.
Okay. Well, that's going to come out somewhere in our conversation today. So you grew up in Boston. So what were you like as a kid? I mean, were you like a nerdy kid or were you, I don't know, I'm asking you things that are totally random and off the top because I want to figure out how you got to college and what you wanted to study in school and that part of the story.
I mean, I think I was a pretty typical kid, a little nerdy and precocious. And I was into dance and singing and theater, and I played sports even though I was physically uncoordinated.
I'm laughing because we're like soul sisters. I had Logan Scott from the Disney Corporation, and he studied dance in college. And you, next thing you know, we're singing Hakuna Matata on the show. So I'm not going to go there with you. But so you have this creative side to you, which I think is kind of cool. So what did you study in school?
Yeah, so I had the great privilege of having some really strange internships when I was in high school. I think also I had the benefit of The West Wing being on TV and watching Allison Janney's character, CJ Craig, and was just enthralled by this person, this role, and politics. I was actually very interested in politics as a young kid. And so my goal in life was to be the press secretary for the White House or to be the chief marketing officer for the New England Patriots.
Oh, I know you are a Patriots fan, and there's a sports show that wants to have you on. I don't know a damn thing, which is actually the most appropriate way to say it. But all I know is that the Patriot fans are rock solid, and they are who they are, and it's in their DNA. So is that you?
That's me. So I went to Barnard College in New York City and studied economics because I thought to myself, if I want to learn how to sell things, right, whether you're in politics or marketing, you really need to understand how the economy works. And I almost minored in theology. I was one credit short, but in my mind, the theology classes were the ones that were my favorite because I wanted to understand what motivated people. And really, there isn't a better marketer than God.
I'm so glad you said that because I think our listeners are used to me saying it. So when you say it, I'm like, if you were here, I'd give you like a huge fist bump. So yeah, so God, the grand marketer of all eternity, is going to give some good guidance.
Yeah, I mean, like, you have to give credit where credit's due, right? The church and the different, and I'm not just saying the churches and Christianity, I'm saying all of the churches, all of the systems, you know, they are incredible marketers. They packaging the messaging well, they know where and how to deliver the message. They are able to create evangelists out of the message. I mean, it's the best marketing tool to like to watch and learn from.
Of course, you know, last week we had the economy of Francesco and all of these young people from around the world who have embraced the call by the ultimate modern change maker himself, Pope Francis. So here you are telling us the same thing.
Yeah. And then I finished college and ended up in advertising. So I spent about over a decade in advertising, working at some big corporate ad shops, some of the most creative ad shops, working on big corporate clients.
You look too young to have spent a decade in that business because that's a hard business. I mean, you work grueling hours on demand with clients. That's my perception. Is that kind of what it's like on the inside?
Yeah, it's definitely a demanding job. It's exciting, though. I mean, it felt like you were surrounded by so many different things that make the world go around, right? Like the business side, the marketing side, the creative side, media. You're kind of at this like interesting intersection of commerce and media and entertainment and production. And so I loved it, but it's long hours, but it's something you got to really be passionate about it to do it for a long time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're in the end of our second season on our show, and all the things you said about advertising ring true to the podcast industry. So here you were at this place a decade in. Then what happened? Did you have a moment that says it's time for a pivot? How does that story unfold?
I wish it was that clean, but it was quite messy, actually. It was, you know, when you start to reach that point in your career where you start kind of saying, okay, like, which boss do I want to be? And I kept looking in different directions. Do I want to be on the client side? Do I want to run an agency? Do I want to be the head of some vertical inside the agency? And I wasn't really loving the options that were in front of me.
Yeah.
And so I kept saying like, oh, I don't know if I really want that job. And so I end up, my career kind of plateaued because I didn't kind of know what direction I was headed in, you know?
Right.
But all the external metrics, I was succeeding.
Yeah, of course you were. You're this hard-charging, smart woman. And so I would sense that maybe it was, I'm projecting myself, but I probably would have been a little frustrated until, you know, if there was something deep inside me that was driving me. So was there something deep inside you that was driving you?
Yeah. And I think that what I ended up doing was leaving the agency world. And I started my own little branding shop because my theory was that I was unhappy, not because of the grueling hours, not because of the, you know, the kind of process of it or the repetitive nature of some of the aspects of the job, but because I felt like I was lending my skills to selling things that people didn't really need. Mm. And the funny part is the higher you get in the advertising kind of rung of things, like the bigger, the sexier the brands, for me, the less disconnected they were with my values.
Yeah.
So, you know, the funny part is early on, I was working on a lot of brands and I was like, oh, cool. I feel so connected to this brand, you know, like, let's go on. But then the higher you get, you actually end up working on, like, you know, soda water and beer and all of these kind of sexy brands where I was like, is this really what I want to be spending my time doing?
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, you know, is this where my values are? And so when I started my own company, I said, okay, well, I'm going to focus on brands that I connect with, that I feel like are doing something good in the world. Mm. And that is what I tried to do, is I focused on impact brands. And so not all of my brands were like nonprofits. Some of them were for-profit corporations. Actually, I had like a large CPG company as well. But the work that we were doing was focused on something impactful.
Yeah, let me stop you there. We always litter our show with acronyms. CPG, what does that mean?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Like consumer packaged goods.
Okay. That's like, good. Yeah. And then there was something else I wanted you to clarify. This is just fascinating because this is a whole industry I don't know anything about. So, impact brands. Tell our listeners what impact brands are. I kind of intuitively know it's like the feel good values based businesses. Is that what an impact brand is? And give us an example.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are some, I mean, everything has an impact, right? You can invest in a tobacco company and it has impact. It's just a matter of what direction that impact is. So
positive impact. Yes.
Yeah. So for me, I was focused on brands that aligned with my values and had a positive impact on the world in terms of whether they were trying to, for one of my brands was a computer company that was trying to reduce all of its environmental emissions and its paper and whatever, right? So they were trying to contribute to the environmental goods of the world. I had a tech company that was trying to connect underserved communities to this product that they were offering. I had a nonprofit that was trying to shift the perceptions inside the continent of Africa so that people would start to want to do business with them and invest in them and use and see Africa, the continent, as a resource. So yeah. Lots of different companies and brands across array of shapes and forms. So some nonprofit, some for-profit, some B Corp.
Yeah. Now, this is fascinating to me because I had almost a parallel experience, but in the investment banking world. So I was an investment banker, spun off to become an independent financial advisor. Again, these kind of control over the clients that you work with. Some of mine had to do with consolidation in the industry. So it's not exactly a parallel story, but what I found, which I'm sensing in the way you talk about this work, is that for me, it was a very exciting time because I got to control what I got to work on and I got to direct things. It can also be very exhausting, but also invigorating.
Well, yeah, it was interesting. When I was running my shop, I learned two things about myself. One is that I'm pretty bad at new business.
And, buy that.
Oh, yeah. No, pretty bad at new business. But I love doing the work itself.
I see.
So
okay.
I think it was interesting to me to say, you know, I really wasn't interested in doing the kind of outward facing showboating to bring in the business. I really just wanted to work on the projects.
Yeah.
And so for me, that was really difficult. And the second thing, especially when you're running a 2 or 3 person company, you kind of need to bring in that.
Oh, yeah. Or have a partner business. Who's good at that. Yeah,
exactly. And the second thing I learned was, there are so many amazing companies that are doing so many unique and positive things for the world. And it really energized me and was a beautiful education in the kind of social good world. And I was so impressed with the depth with which these organizations had studied and worked. And I got a front seat to it. And it was really, really lovely to learn all of these incredible different approaches and different business applications to doing good. And it's kind of what got me really, really inspired. Like, oh, I could really lean into this and potentially this could be my career. And while I was building my business in parallel at the same time, we had taken our small family foundation and actually converted it into a public foundation.
Oh, that's huge. I remember when the Pew Charitable Trust spun off and became independent. That is a lot of work.
It is a lot of work, not a journey I suggest. If anyone is in that position, please just shut your company down and start a new one. I think that that would have been much easier. But we did that because much like a startup has their like friends and family investment, and then while they're like with their heads down trying to build that MVP, that most viable product. And that was kind of what we did, is we had a 15-year friends and family round where we were building our products. And when we finally were finished,
you're talking about the foundation now, right? And
yeah,
I love MVP, not most valuable player, you know, your football analogy.
Most viable product. So it's like a startup term. Yeah,
I know. And I just want to make sure our listeners caught that, because I think it's wonderful.
We realized that we had about 20. And once we realized that we had about 20, we were like, oh, well, these are most, some are scalable, some are not designed to scale. And if we're going to get to that next level, you know, we need to pull up more chairs to this table. And so for us to bring more people into the fold and to bring more seats to the table, we converted to a public organization. So I was heavily involved in that transition with my family.
Yeah. Can I stop you there? So you had this entrepreneurial venture going on, and then you had this other set of dynamic things going on in the family space. So how did they come crashing together?
You know, the funny thing about any type of entrepreneur is that we tend to get overly involved in things. And so,
so I was
quite involved in what my family was working on. And, you know, every time I would have an opinion about something, the result would be, well, then you do it.
And of course,
Yeah. And so I ended up, you know, helping to build a lot of these things.
It's kind of the curse of being competent, right?
Yeah, I guess. But I think that people are competent in a lot of different ways. And I think for me, so we ended up on a search for the right executive director. And what we were looking for was someone with a deep understanding of the impact space and the social good space, but also someone that really understood that as an organization, we were going to take risks. We were going to fail. We were going to pivot and scale up. We were going to operate kind of entrepreneurially with innovation at the core of what we're trying to deliver to the folks that we want to serve. And we couldn't find someone. I mean, this was a decade, this was like 6-7 years ago. So we couldn't find someone with that, with balance. Now there are a lot of people with that balance, which is so exciting.
I think the world is
a better place because of that balance. And so I reluctantly took the helm of the organization for a year. That was the agreement between me and the board.
That's how it all starts.
I said, you know, I'll take this role for a year and that will give you some runway to find the right folks. And that was 4.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been running this organization from starting with, I think, 100 villages when I became the president to 900 villages. And
okay, let's stop there, because our listeners probably don't know when you say village. Last week when we talked to the Economy of Francesco, they divide their movement into villages, and there are 12 of them. So our listeners have some conceptualization of a village. Yeah. But when you talk about village and the Desai Foundation, what does that mean? Tell us about the work of the foundation.
Absolutely. So the Desai Foundation is an organization that empowers women and children through community programming to elevate health and livelihood. And we do that both in India, in rural communities, and in America, in urban communities. And so our focus is not just on delivering mechanisms of health and livelihood, but to really cultivate dignity for the women that we serve.
Now, can I ask you, why women, why India, and why these particular places in the world?
So the easiest answer for why women is because they are a better investment.
Wait a minute. Say that again. I did a photo shoot a week or so ago on Wall Street in front of the bronze statue of the bull. And I don't know if you know the story, but there's this new bronze statue of a young girl kind of facing up the bull. And
yep, so, the fearless girl.
Exactly. And so, you know, are you one of these fearless girls?
I think we all have to be a little fearless to build anything.
Exactly. So women, you said women are a better investment. What do you mean?
Yeah. So there's reams of data that show, especially from the UN and from a variety of other organizations, that when you give a woman 100 cents, she generally invests 90 of those cents back into the community by supporting
really?
Other people in the community. When you give a man a dollar, he usually invests 40 cents into the community and keeps 60 for himself. And so from a math perspective, if I'm on the ground serving people, it's just a better investment. I think the other reason, of course, for me is that because women often find themselves in positions, especially in developing countries, but let's be honest, also here in the United States, where they are being underpaid, undervalued, and overlooked. And so for us, it's about it being a better investment, but it's also just being, for us, about being the right thing to do.
Exactly. Wow. I mean, I don't know if our listeners want to just take a moment and let that sink in. I mean, we are a business show at our heart, but we talk about the social and moral value of business. And you've just laid a big one on us. Okay, so you're investing in women, like doubled down big time. So why India and why Boston and New York?
So one of the original founding principles that came from the founding of the organization over 20 years ago was we wanted to serve the communities that had fostered my family. And so those communities are in India and in the United States, and specifically in Boston and New York. And originally with the Desai Foundation in India, we were working in Gujarat, but now we have expanded to 4 states. So,
well, tell everybody where Gujarat is, if I pronounce that correctly, and the other states, just to kind of give someone who doesn't know Indian geography at least a sense of things.
Gujarat is one of the western states of India, borders Pakistan, it's on the water. And Gujarat, Rajasthan, which is north of that, Maharashtra, which is where Bombay is, and Uttar Pradesh, which is slightly north of Maharashtra. So those are the 4 states in which we operate.
Okay. I think I've got a mental picture, and hopefully listeners are even more geographically attuned than I am. So that kind of puts us in a space in Boston and New York. So tell us a little bit more about the projects that you're working on, because you're doing some major change-making kind of stuff. So
Thanks.
Tell us about it.
You know, our programs are all designed to focus and center the women in the village. So a lot of our women, and by the way, by village, I just mean a rural community in some of these areas. So our programs are designed to cultivate dignity for those we serve by providing them access to health. So we do lots of different health programs, health camps that serve children, women, vision camps, gynec camps. You know, a lot of these communities don't have local hospitals nearby.
What are gynec camps?
Gynecological camps.
Okay, got it. I learn a lot from everyone who's on the show. So everything is new to me at some level. Got it.
In India, the shorthand of gynecology, like instead of saying GYN, they say gynec. Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Sorry, I'm always on the phone and I spend my whole day in 2 different languages. So it's
and I don't know how you do it like in the time zones too. That's intense. So you've got an incredible portfolio and all of this is working towards what kind of big picture goal?
Yeah. So these are the health programs. And then we have the livelihood programs, which are teaching skills. So whether it's sewing or candle making, beautician, we actually have a couple of electrician classes for the women as well.
I love that.
And the idea is to provide them with a skill that gives them the flexibility that they need to earn a living. Now, one of the things that there are lots and lots of skill building organizations in India, we're not unique in that. However, what we do is tag on 5 days of entrepreneurship at the end of every single one of our skill building classes. Why we do this is because a lot of these women aren't going to take a sewing class and then take a 9-to-5 job at a factory. That's not practical for their way of life. And it's not practical for whether they even have access, you know, within a couple kilometers walking to back and forth to even a job like that. So how do you create livelihood opportunities for them in the comfort of their own home where they feel comfortable and safe, where they can work flexible hours and just try to earn a little bit more money by teaching them how to start their own shop? I have a great story of a young lady who took our beautician classes, and the beautician classes are great because you can actually earn almost a month's salary in one day if you get hired for like a wedding, right? To do like hair and makeup.
You know, I know what I pay my hairdresser in Washington, D.C. Yeah. I can imagine, you know, exactly what you're saying. I think of Indian weddings as these pageantry and multi-day celebrations. And so bring on the hair.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a really valuable skill that they can earn a living off of. And so imagine you're making like, you know, 2-3 weeks salary in one day in an environment where they feel safe. They're around other women. You know, they don't feel like they have to like travel to a job every day, whatever the case may be. So we have this one woman who took this course And she had called us and said, you know, a couple of weeks later, she had all these customers and all these clients, and her clientele was getting so, her list was getting so long that she started to bring on more beauticians. So she called us up and she goes, "Can I recruit some of the other women that you've trained?" And we said, "Of course you can. This is amazing." And so she started slowly, slowly build her small business. And just right before the pandemic began, she just opened up her first shop. So it's like so wonderful to hear that, like, that they are able to take that business training that we give them and apply it to the skill.
Oh, that's
so
wonderful.
Those are the two large buckets that we operate in. But the third bucket is around menstrual health. And, you know, bringing it back to business for you guys for a second, you know, menstrual health isn't just about keeping 23% more girls in school, you know, the 23% of girls that drop out of school at the onset of puberty because they don't have access to clean toilets or menstrual pads.
Wait a second. Wait, that's a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Or the 71% of girls that don't know what their period is before they get it. So they suffer that trauma.
Oh, that must be horrifying. It's like, I'm going to die. And wow. You just don't think, I mean, I have three daughters. And so I know what that experience is like in kind of a modern economy, but in a place that's much more rural and, you know, has its own cultures and mores and all of that. What you're telling me is pretty amazing in 2021.
One in five girls in the United States drops out of sports after the onset of poverty. I mean, there are lots of issues right here in the U.S. around period poverty and access to menstrual health.
Wow.
And so, you know, this problem is not just around, and then like all the infections that are occurring because pads are being used and they're using rags and other like husk and things like that to manage their periods. So one of the things that we are trying to solve for isn't just, there's the health issue, but then there's the education issue. And then there's the livelihood issue. If you don't have access to the proper menstrual products, you aren't going to be able to hold a job or you know, leave the house for a couple of days a year. That's lost income and wages. And ultimately, we believe that that ladders up to the entire GDP of the nation. If so many girls are dropping out of school and women aren't able to hold their jobs, you know, the entire GDP of the nation is suffering.
Yeah, let me just let that sink in for a minute. 25% of the GDP of India. I mean, if you think about that in global terms, that's enormous. You're doing transformational work. I'm patting you on the back virtually.
Thank you.
Well, it's important. And you go back to what you said earlier about making a meaningful investment. I think you picked a winner here, you know, from the former investment banker. You know, I'd put that one in my portfolio.
Yeah. Well, speaking of how we invest the money, right? We really think about the long-term success of these because I don't think that the success of a nonprofit is to exist for 100 years. I think the success of a nonprofit is to go in, solve a problem, and leave.
And I love that.
So what we're trying to do is ultimately a lot of our programs. Now, I will say our health programs, right? Are not sustainable because the health programs are more about giving care, but it is also about connecting people with hospitals and all that kind of stuff. And if the demand elevates in these rural communities, the hospitals will come eventually, right? So
right.
If we're continuously educating the people in the village about, hey, you actually have to get a health checkup. You actually have to go get this screened. You know, you should be taking these vaccines. So, but on the vocational side and the menstrual side, you know, we really try to work to develop sustainable models for these programs so that the local community's invested, we're invested, and then our donors are invested, and it can create more long-term sustainable growth. And that's why we've been able to expand, you know, from 100 villages to 900 villages. It's not because I'm raising a ton more money. I mean, I am, don't get me wrong, but it is because we've been able to create economies of scale as we've grown the programs.
All right. I'm going to like hit you with the question. This is like the What Does It Profit podcast question. It goes back to the name of our show. And I ask it in two different ways, one at a very personal level and one at kind of a global level. And I want to talk about the personal level first. And the name of this episode is The Economic Value of Dignity. And I think this fits your story nicely because of what I've been able to listen to on other shows and read about in your work. There's a concept of dharma.
It's dharma.
Dharma, dharma, dharma.
Yeah, I think Americans pronounce it dharma, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Explain to our listeners what that is. And does that at all help you think about this question? The work that you do in the world, how does it profit your soul? How does it profit who you are? How is it core to you?
Yeah. So my life has always been guided by these two words, dignity and dharma. And for me, you know, dharma is the concept of your, like, I think the American translation is like the righteous path, but it's not totally accurate in my opinion. It is really about what is your role and your path right now. Mm. And your dharma changes and evolves, right? The cycle of dharma in Hindu philosophy is first you are a student, you know, then you are a spouse, then you are a sage. You know, there's like four different stages of what like your dharmological evolution. And so it is this evolving concept. And so for me, my dharma has always been, what is my role as a daughter? You know, what is my role as a member of society? And what is my dharma as a business leader? And for me, my dharma is really about shifting the stigmas and the barriers that hold people back, the invisible barriers that really shouldn't even be there, right, to providing economic opportunity and health to those I serve. And hopefully, if I'm lucky, inspiring other people to shift maybe what they're doing on a day-to-day basis to just do that one extra step of good. You know, like I'm not discouraging making money. I'm not discouraging corporate life or anything like that. It's more just maybe take that one extra step to make sure you're offsetting or you're aligned with your values. And then for dignity, which is also related to kind of value, in my opinion, you know, dignity is really about not just self-confidence, but it is a reflective concept. You know, dignity is this abundant resource. And I want to remind people that you're not just responsible for your own dignity, you're responsible for the dignity of everyone you touch. But man, I can't give you dignity, but I can definitely help you achieve it.
I see.
I can't take your dignity, but I can diminish it.
Interesting.
And what if we all ventured to believe that dignity is this abundant resource that we can give generously and it will return back to us generously? Because when you have dignity, when a girl in a village has dignity, she's able to have faith that she deserves more. She's able to stand up to her, for herself. She's able to educate herself. She's able to support the people she loves and pursue her dreams. You know, our tagline at the Desai Foundation is dream beyond, because we want everyone that we serve to dream beyond their circumstances.
Oh, yeah. Well, Marian from last week from Brazil founded this organization called the Dream Factory. So she's saying the exact same thing you're saying in India and in Boston and New York. She's saying it in Brazil. So you're on to something that I think is very universal. So let me ask the question, the second part of that question, which is if what you're doing in the world becomes more of a norm, how does the world profit? How does the world benefit if the world becomes the way you hope it to be?
I think it's a matter of metrics. You know, it's a matter of what you're using as your measuring stick. I think that if we're just using dollars and cents and rupees for a measuring stick, you know, I'm sure I could do some math on how if every woman in India actually joined the workforce and became a more productive, you know, member of society, blah, 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 right? I could do that. But when we empower women, like I said, it's a better investment. It elevates the entire community. And, you know, we can really change what poverty looks like. We can really change what holding back women look like, where women feel more empowered to ask for the pay that they deserve, to not be embarrassed if they say, hey, I'm going to be in late today. My period is out of control this morning. I need to come in a couple hours late, and have the society not treat them differently. You know, so many of the stigmas in periods are kind of man-made stigmas about being unclean and being told that you can't cook or you can't sleep in the same house or you can't pray and you can't touch any books. And that's 3 to 7 days a month that a woman is told that she is not worthy of God's love. There is no way for a society to rise if so many people are being held back, half of the people are being held back. So for me, the big picture around what is it profit, it's when women come to the table, they always add value. And the more and more seats that we're bringing to that table, you know, what could we become?
Well, you know, I don't think that anyone has ever answered the question exactly that way, because you come to this place from the mega way. And so what I think is so beautiful about that is that's exactly what we talk about on our show, the social and moral value of business. And you get an A+ today. So,
oh, wow.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have immensely enjoyed this. I'm going to kind of wrap things up here. But before I do, I want to make sure our listeners know where to find you and know if they are called to this work or inspired by what you're doing, how can they engage? How do they find out about your work?
Yeah, thank you for that. So you can visit the Desai, D-E-S-A-I, foundation.org. And there's a ton of information there. You can follow us on all the socials at Desai Foundation. And it's going to be a really exciting month of May. It's Menstrual Health Hygiene Month. So we will be doing a campaign where we'll be inviting menstruators and non-menstruators to pledge their periods because someone you know is bloody fabulous. So we are
inviting you to
participate in that campaign.
In my day, that was just a taboo thing. You just couldn't say it. But now, you know, women rise. You know, this is great. You're leading a great revolution, as Dr. Martin Luther King had said. So, Megha, thank you so much for joining
us on
What Does It Profit?
Thank you for having me. This was lovely.
You've been listening to What Does It Profit? Here we are. We've reached the end of our second 12-episode season. Thanks for hanging in there with us through our growing pains. There are countless to thank for supporting and encouraging us on this leg of our journey. We don't want to miss acknowledging anyone, but for now, we'd like to shout out to our community of support at Georgetown University and at CastBox, one of our favorite podcast apps. Now, here's the time when I get to tell you what happens next. We're going to take a pit stop. Conjure up in your mind an image of Formula One or NASCAR. The What Does It Profit podcast crew is bringing it in, filling up the tank, changing the tires, souping up the engine, and yes, polishing the chrome. You get the analogy. For the next 4 months, we'll be making some enhancements to the show with an eye towards doing two big things: improving the listening experience and building out the social media infrastructure so that we can really begin to engage with you, the listener. Because that's the point, right? You invest your time with us, and we should try to keep bringing you better and better audio. Don't worry, we're not leaving you here. Stay with the race car analogy for a minute. Let's just say we're also going to be doing some pacing laps. For the next 4 months, we're going to bring you short form updates and highlights from our back catalog. We're doing this to help refresh the lessons that we've learned along the way. Look for these episodes on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month from May to August. But we couldn't end the season without a proper send-off. On April 28th, we'll release our Season 2 bonus episode. This bonus episode shares a conversation that I had with Stephen Donziger, the human rights lawyer whose work we introduced you to in Season 1 in our episode on shareholder activism, and whose story we revisited in the Season 1 bonus episode on the Ecuadorian Chernobyl. As you might remember, Stephen is the human rights lawyer who has taken on the cause of justice for generations of Ecuadorians terrorized by the reckless behavior of Texaco, the predecessor company to Chevron, the world's fourth largest petrochemical company. This is a modern-day David and Goliath story of epic proportion. If you're not yet a What Does It Profit podcast subscriber, subscribe wherever you listen to audio, because you won't want to miss this conversation. In the meantime, we urge you to connect with our show on our LinkedIn page to meet other What Does It Profit podcast listeners who engage with us there. And follow us on Twitter at WDIP Podcast as we spend these next few months building out our community on all the other social media platforms. And of course, don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. And meet our team and sign up for our weekly newsletter on our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. This episode was produced by Jordan Gosporé and edited by Switch and Board Studios. And the executive producer is me. Special thanks to our Season 2 interns, Niels, Hannah, and Sean, other team members, and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?